Okay, questions? Questions? No questions? So, an anonymous vote on whether you want to continue to do overhead. So I am now walking. You saw me walk for the review session. So an anonymous vote on whether you want to do Blackboard or overheads in the future. So I'm going to give you this little sheet of paper. You can write the word Blackboard or overhead. And when you walk out, you can put it in that box. Any questions? So we kind of quit in the middle of chapter 4, where we were dealing with charges that are bound together. So most material comes in versions that have positive and negative charges on it, and you can't rip them apart easily. But they still produce electric fields. And what we showed is that if we added up the electric field due to all of those dipoles, we got something that we could express in terms of the sort of relationships that this is a vote. So you can vote for more Blackboard or more overheads. Did you get a vote sheet too? Okay. And your exam, if you didn't know it, is sitting in your mailbox downstairs. So there's an equivalent charge that we can deal with just like we did in chapter 2. That's minus the gradient or the divergence of the polarization. And on the surfaces, there are surface charge densities that we could calculate by a dot product of the polarization. And since the charge, you know, came together, if we add up all of the bound charge, we have to get zero. Right? So there's as much positive charge as there is negative charge because it came as dipoles. So if we actually add up this over some surface, we're going to get zero. Almost everything we're going to do in this class deals with so-called linear dielectrics, where the polarization is proportional to the electric field. And at least what I'm going to do is call the proportionality constant epsilon naught times chi, because then chi comes out dimensionless. We're going to be highly concerned with this D field, which is just defined to be epsilon naught E plus the polarization. So some things kind of have physical reality and some things are kind of just mathematics. And I would say the D field is just mathematics. It makes a lot of equations simpler, but you couldn't really ever measure the D field directly. And it turns out that for linear dielectrics, it's just a multiple of the electric field, and this dimensionless dielectric constant is the thing that basically connects the electric field to the D field. So if we kind of rewrite the equations, the electric field responds to all of the charge. Whether it's bound or free, it doesn't make any difference as far as the electric field is concerned, and that makes sense for something that has physical reality, right? It doesn't matter whether that charge is bound or not, it's going to respond to it one way or the other. The D field only sees the free charge, the charge that we can move around ourselves. The curl of the electric field is zero, which allows us to make a potential energy function, but the curl of the D field is in general not zero. Particularly, it's not usually not zero at the boundary. So from the divergence, we can use Gauss's law to get an integral form. And of course, the integral form for D is just going to see the free charge. The integral form for the electric field is going to see both the bound and the free charge. And we talked mostly then about boundary conditions. The change in the normal component of D when you went through a boundary just depended on the existence of free charge on the surface of that boundary. The tangential component of the electric field had to not change at all. And this was required in order for the voltage to exist. And for linear dielectrics, if you kind of go through the math, the bound charge density is proportional to the free charge density. So typically what we will have is no free charge density in a region of space, and so we can use Laplace's equation just as well inside this material. And that, you know, at first blush should sound kind of crazy, because there's all sorts of plus and minus charge inside, say, polarized water, but still, Laplace's equation will be satisfied inside that material. So we went through a couple of what I want to stress are unusual cases, but I think they might be helpful cases to think about. What's unusual about them is we're thinking about material that has a constant polarization. So almost all of this course, we're going to be talking about material where the polarization is proportional to the electric field. So this is the electric equivalent of a permanent magnet where we have polarization without an external electric field. And we looked at kind of three distinct geometries. So if we're thinking about something like a penny, something like a parallel plate capacitor, and we have this stuff polarized, then there's going to be, and the polarization is up, then there's going to be positive P dot N on the top of this penny and negative P dot N at the bottom of this penny. So it's just like a parallel plate capacitor. And since the polarization is constant, if we take the divergence of it, we're going to get zero. So there's only surface charge density in this case. And the parallel plate capacitor is a problem that you've worked in 200, right? You know that the electric field is the surface charge density divided by epsilon naught. So roughly speaking, the electric field between the inside the penny is going to be the polarization divided by epsilon naught. Since the polarization is up but the electric field is down, the D field is pretty small inside the penny. And outside the penny, it's also going to be pretty small, because you know that the electric field is mostly confined to the inside of the capacitor. The electric field outside of the capacitor is going to be small. But the small bit of D field would be going up inside the capacitor, and it would still be going up outside the capacitor. And it would work its way, its round, as a dipole sort of field, right? Because we have positive and negative charge separated by some distance L. If we have the other extreme, if we have something like a pencil, then we're going to have positive charge at the top of this pencil and negative charge at the bottom of this pencil, and it's going to look kind of like two separated point charges. And if it's a very long pencil and we're very far away from those point charges, then the electric field will basically be zero, and so the D field will be up equal to the polarization, right, corresponding to zero electric field. And the electric field outside would just be, you know, away from this positive charge and towards this negative charge, with basically a 1 over r squared sort of dependence. Okay, so the in-between case is a sphere, and we worked this out in great detail, where we had a surface charge density that was p cosine theta that comes from the dot product of the polarization, which is in the k direction, and the normal, which is in the r hat direction. And k dot r hat is cosine theta. So we have, you know, positive charge in the northern hemisphere and negative charge in the southern hemisphere. And it's kind of like a twisted parallel plate capacitor. So the electric field is still going to go down. And we worked it out and found out that the electric field was exactly in the down direction, and it was polarization divided by 3 epsilon naught. And that meant that the D field had to be up at 2/3 of the polarization. So you can kind of see the extreme. D is small, D is getting big, D is all of P. And corresponding to the electric field is big and down, the electric field is moderate and down, the electric field is pretty small and down. In all of these cases, if we get far enough away from them, they're just going to look like a big dipole, right? We can learn that from the multipole expansion. So questions about kind of first half of chapter 4? Okay, so it's back to working, you know, kind of typical sorts of problems. And, you know, what's a problem that we've worked in the past was the case of a conductor that was in a previously uniform electric field. So let's have a dielectric that's in a previously uniform electric field. So here I've got this dielectric ball, radius r, that's in what was previously a uniform electric field. The thing is azimuthally symmetrical, and there is no free charge that's at all in evidence, so we can apply Laplace's equation every place we want to. And it's the usual sort of statement. We have inside and outside sort of solutions, right? Because in general, of course, we know that the solution to Laplace's equation is a linear combination of the A-type terms and the C-type terms, all times a Pn of cosine theta. If we're inside, then we can't have a term like that, because that would be producing a voltage that was infinity. And there's nothing special going on at the origin. Now, approximately speaking, we can't have these guys outside, because they're going to produce an infinite voltage at infinity. But if we're going to produce a constant electric field, we're going to need a potential that is minus E naught times Z, so that when we take the gradient of it, we get an electric field that's constant in the Z direction. And since Z is equal to R cosine theta, we're going to have an A1 term that's different from the rest. Okay, so inside, we're just going to have the A terms. Outside, let's separate out the n equals 1 term. We may have this term that is minus E naught R times P1, and we may have a term that is C1 divided by R squared, all of that times P1, and we may have a lot of leftover terms, Cn over R to the n plus 1 times Pn. Okay, so usually we don't have these sort of A-type terms, but if we have a constant electric field, we have to have the voltage going to infinity at plus and minus infinity. So now it's boundary condition time. So what we have to have is the voltage agreeing when we evaluate these things at R equals capital R. That equation is equivalent to no change in the tangential component of the electric field. Right? If the voltages are the same as we move along the surface of the sphere, then the derivatives along the surface of the sphere are going to be equal, and so the tangential component of the electric field will automatically be equal. Okay, and the other thing we're going to have is that the no change in the normal component of the D field. And of course, we can calculate the normal component of D because it's going to be related to the normal component, the radial component of the E field, which is the R derivative of phi. And we would need to multiply this, of course, by the dielectric constant in order to get the D field. So this is an epsilon naught, yes. Luckily, it won't be around for long. A little bit louder? So that's the change in the tangential component of E. So remember, our two boundary conditions are no change in the tangential component of E and no change in the normal component of D. Usually, we don't use this equation as it stands because it's equivalent to having the voltage be the same, and having the voltage be the same is usually easier to deal with. But if we really wanted to, we could take the theta derivatives of this thing and say that the theta derivatives, which would give us the tangential component of the electric field, had to be the same. But boy, that looks like a mess in comparison to this. It's got to give us the same equation.
We would only need to do theta derivatives.
A little bit louder?
We would only need to do the theta derivatives.
Right. So there can't be an electric field in the phi direction. Or said differently, if you take the derivative of the voltage in the phi direction, you get zero, so you're automatically going to have no change in that direction. Okay. So roughly speaking, what we would expect is this piece of dielectric is going to polarize. So it's going to end up with having positive bound charge here and negative bound charge there. And as a result, at great distance, we're going to have a dipole plus this constant electric field. Exactly what happens on the inside of this, you know, maybe is going to be complicated, but roughly speaking, there's going to be a new piece of the electric field due to that bound charge density. Okay, so it's mostly then just a matter of writing down the equations and seeing what we can learn from them and remembering Fourier's trick. So let me kind of remind you about the simple version of Fourier's trick, which I really need to convince you that it's the same. So if we have a vector space, we can think about a vector as being a linear combination of lots of components and the corresponding unit vectors. And it's pretty much a guarantee that if I dot both sides with some particular unit vector, the sum is going to collapse, and I'm only going to get that. What corresponds to a dot product is, of course, an integral. What corresponds to these unit vectors are our orthogonal set of polynomials, and this is all that Fourier's trick is about. So the coefficients of two vectors that are equal requires that all of the components have to be equal in each respective direction. Okay, so let's write all that down. So we want phi in evaluated on the surface of the sphere, and that's going to be add up all of these a's. That has to equal the voltage using the outside formula, but evaluating right on the surface of the sphere. And that's going to be, well, we've treated the n equals 1 term as a little bit special. But what we have left over is all those other terms. Okay. So again, the coefficient of Pm on this side of the equation has to match the coefficient of Pm on that side of the equation. And if we want, we could actually dot with some Pm and integrate and have the collapse of the sum. Or we can just think about this as two vectors. The corresponding components have to be the same. So for n equals 1, things are a little bit special. We only have a1, r to the 1, and then this is the unit vector that had to be the same. On the other side of the equation, we have minus e1 r plus c1 over r squared. For n not equal to 1, it's going to look the same over here, right? We're going to have a n r to the n, but on the other side of the equation, we're going to have c n over r to the n plus 1. Okay, so from one equation, we get an infinite number of equations, which should sound funny. But it's exactly the same thing what's true of vector equation. If you have a three-dimensional vector equation, then it amounts to three separate equations, one for x, one for y, one for z. Okay, so next thing we want to look at is the normal component of D. And what we know is that if we take the radial component of the electric field inside and multiply it by the corresponding epsilon, we're supposed to get the same D field that we get outside. Right? So no K factor outside because it's vacuum. That is to say, K is equal to 1. And inside we have a dielectric that has some dielectric constant K. And we can, of course, calculate these radial components of E by taking the derivative of the corresponding value of phi. And we might as well cancel off those epsilon naughts, and we might as well cancel off the minus signs, and then work out what this equation is going to say. Okay, so if we do that, on the inside, we're going to have k times the sum of n times a n r to the n minus 1. Again, we've plugged in lowercase r as capital R because that's where the boundary is. And I guess I should write my pn. And on the other side of the equation, we're going to have the derivative with respect to r of, remember, we have kind of a special case for the p equals 1 term. So it's going to give us minus E naught minus C1 divided by R cubed times P1, and then we're going to have all the other terms, which are pretty easy to take the derivative of. So there we're going to have the sum minus N plus 1 Cn divided by R to the N plus 2. This one? This one?
Yep.
That's a 3. So the 3 came from the derivative of the 2. In fact, there should be a 2 then, right? Good to go?
And you're
just adding that stuff. Yeah. So, yep. Okay, so the coefficient of Pn has to be the same on both sides of the equation. So n equals 1 is a little bit special. So for n equals 1, we're going to have k, a1, 1 minus 1 is 0. And here we're going to get minus e0 minus 2 c1 divided by r cubed. And for n not equal to 1, what we're going to have is k times n a n r to the n minus 1 has to be the same as minus n plus 1 c n over r to the n plus 2. Yeah, that's the n that we got from the derivative. So the sum has been eliminated because we've just looked at the coefficient of Cn, of Pn. Yeah, so this was the n equals 1, no Pn because we're just looking at the component that sits in front of P1. And here we're just looking at the component that sits in front of Pn. If we wanted to, we could integrate by Pm and integrate, but it's the same thing as just picking off the component. So is it obvious that all of the a's and c's for n not equal to 1 are 0? So let's think about a simpler system. So I have a, well, what should I call these things? Ax plus by equals 0. And cx plus dy equals 0. Is it obvious that the solution to that is x equals y equals 0? Well, so it's obvious that x equals y equals 0 works, but I don't know if that seems like a really good argument. It is a great argument in the context of Laplace's equation, because we've said that if a solution works, it's the solution, because solutions are unique. If we want to make this a little bit fancier, though, we could say that this is really a matrix equation, A, B, C, D, X, Y equals 0. And if we apply the inverse matrix to this, we're going to get that X and Y are 0. And all of that would be true as long as the determinant of this matrix isn't 0, right? If the determinant of this matrix is 0, then we don't have an inverse, and then kind of all bets are off. But we still have the fact that it's a solution. So if you go back and see what we've got for our ans and cns, it's kind of hard to get them both up there at the same time. So I'm looking at this equation here. And I'm going to rewrite this guy, I guess, a little bit. I'm going to say that this is 0. Well, maybe it's impossible. 0 equals, I'm going to multiply it through by r to the n plus 1. So 0 equals cn minus an r to the 2n plus 1. So this is a homogeneous equation. Homogeneous meaning that we don't have a constant term. We've got a 0 on that side of the equation. And I'm going to do it to the other one too. What I'm trying to do is to make the equations that we've got look like this. And then we can apply that general result. Okay, so the other equations we've got, And I guess for this one, I'm going to bring this term over to this side of the equation. So I'm going to have 0 is equal to n plus 1 cn. And if I multiply through by r to the n plus 2, both sides of the equation, this is going to be plus k n a n r to the 2n plus 1. Okay, so the cn's are kind of like our x's, the an's are kind of like our y's, and in fact, if we're a little bit clever, we might as well call this whole combination y, in which case what we've got is 0 equals 1 times x minus y, and 0 equals n plus 1 plus kny. And it's easy to take the determinant of the corresponding matrix, right? It's this times this minus that times that. So it's going to be kn plus n plus 1. And everything's positive, right? So that's greater than 0. A little bit louder? Yes. And we're probably never going to bother to do this again. Because A, we know that if the zero solution works, it has to be the unique solution. And it's pretty unlikely for the coefficients to actually have a non-zero determinant, right? If you want to check, you can, but they will have a non-zero determinant. Yes? Well, so I'm not sure I like your why. The only thing we've used really is the boundary conditions on the surface of the sphere. So it was the surface conditions at the boundary of the sphere that forced all those A's and C's to be zero. Where we use the fact that the electric field had to be zero, where we use the fact that we didn't have A terms, that was kind of the usual situation. Right, where we couldn't have large voltages at infinity and we couldn't have large voltages at the origin, with the exception being that we did need an electric field, and the electric field is going to produce a voltage that goes ever down in one direction and ever up in one direction. But no quadratic terms or higher terms, because they would make electric fields that went to infinity. Okay. So kind of how the book runs this same argument is more that I don't need those terms, I can make it all work without those terms, and so they're not going to be there, which is a perfectly good argument. But here's kind of a more more in-depth argument that shows kind of why those terms have to be zero. Okay, so what's left then are the n equals 1 terms, and there we do have a constant coefficient. So here we're going to have, and let me divide this equation through by r, because I think it's going to look a little bit better. So I'm going to have a1 minus c1 over r cubed is equal to minus e0. And the other n equals 1 term going to have k times a1 plus 2 c1 over r cubed is equal to minus e0. Right? So here's that. Put that on this side of the equation. We got these guys. Good to go. Okay, so you know, pick your favorite way to solve. So again, these are inhomogeneous linear equations. So we are going to get a non-zero solution. And in fact, it's obvious that 0, 0 doesn't work. So we should be good. So, I don't know, equations like this I'm kind of happy to solve by, say, multiplying the top one by 2 so that I get a cancellation there. So if I rewrite these equations, I'm going to have 2 times a1 minus 2c1 over r cubed is equal to minus 2e0, and k a1 plus 2c1 over r cubed is equal to minus e0. And now when I add those up, the c term is going to cancel out, so I'm going to get k plus 2 times a1 is equal to minus 3e0. Or a1 is equal to minus 3 over k plus 1 e0. That's an e, not an epsilon. Okay, so physically, what does that mean, right? So that means that the inside voltage is going to be A1 R1 times P1, and P1 is just cosine theta. So we're going to have minus 3 E0 divided by K plus 2, and R cosine theta is just Z. So inside, the electric field, when we take the derivative, when we take the gradient of it, it's all going to be in the z direction, and it's going to be 3 e naught over k plus 2, all in the k hat direction, the z direction. Okay, so kind of thinking about this physically, we had plus charge here and minus charge here, bound charges. They're going to make an electric field that is going to cancel in part the electric field that was external. And so if K isn't equal to 1, we're going to have a smaller electric field inside the dielectric than we did outside the dielectric. So the picture was we had bound, so the external electric field went that way. So we had bound charge, positive bound charge there, negative bound charge there. It's going to make an electric field that's in the wrong direction. So the electric field that we're going to get inside is reduced, right? If K is 2, it's going to be 3/4 of what the electric field was.
Is
K is the dielectric constant. So you could look up, for a particular material, you could look it up in the CRC. Right? So for water, it would be around 80. For common solids, it would be 2, 3, 4. For air, which is more or less vacuum, it's like 1.005 or something like that. The other thing that's kind of worth checking, if the dielectric constant is 1, then it's effectively not there, right? It's all vacuum. And so there should be no effect. And if I put K equals 1, I get the same electric field inside as outside. So K goes to 1 means that nothing is there. K goes to infinity kind of corresponds to having a conductor. I'll put it in quotes because it's not always exactly case, but you remember that K shows kind of how stretchable those dipoles are. And in a conductor, they're infinitely stretchable. The electrons go in as far away as they can until they reach the ends. So we know that inside of a conductor, there should be no electric field, and that K in the denominator is going to do exactly that, right? It's going to kill the electric field when we're inside a high K object, a highly polarized object. So if K is huge, this bound charge will pretty much cancel the outside electric field. Okay, so I think I lost my other solution. I got it. Okay, so we're also interested in what the electric field is outside. I know we can kind of pick our favorite way of solving these equations. I'm trying to decide which one's my favorite. They're all about equally good or bad. Well, yeah, let's use this guy, I guess. So that guy says that 2 times C1 divided by R cubed is equal to minus E naught minus K times A1. And we know what A1 is. If we look here, A1 is equal to minus 3 over K plus 1 times the electric field. So if we put all of these things together, everything has the electric field as an overall constant. Minus a minus is plus, so we're going to have 3K divided by K plus 1 minus 1. On. Thank you. K plus 2. So obviously we can see a common denominator, so we're going to end up with 2K minus 2 divided by K plus 2 all times the electric field, or if you want, 2 times K minus 1. And of course the 2's cancel out on both sides, so C1 is equal to K minus 1 divided by K plus 2 all times E naught R cubed. Okay, so again, if K is 1, then there should be no effect, right? There should be, so maybe I should comment, this term here is producing a dipole at large distances. But if there's nothing there, the constant electric field isn't going to polarize something to make a dipole. So there should be no dipole term. You can see K equals 1 does that. If K goes to infinity, we're going to get 1 over 1, and we're back to the case that we had for a conducting sphere. Okay, questions? So it's just the usual sort of stuff for Laplace's equation. Well, there's another Laplace equation example in the book, but let's, at least for a second, try and move on to images. So images, you know, we've said before that you kind of have to see a solution and it works, as opposed to kind of a systematic approach. But let's imagine that we've got a boundary between two dielectrics. So this one has dielectric constant K1, this one has dielectric constant K2. And I have a real charge that's in the number one region. And that charge is at some distance d from the boundary. So what am I going to use for my image charges? And I think what's a little bit, there are lots of things that are a little bit confusing. One of the many things that is a little bit confusing is we're going to have different image charges for different parts of the world. So when I ask what the electric field is in region 1, what I'm going to have, of course, is my real charge, and I'm going to have a image charge, Q prime. Okay, so if you ask me what the electric field is on this side of the boundary, I'm going to use this setup.
Wait, I don't get what. Why did you write it down?
Say again? Well, you'll see in a second. So it's going to be different. If you ask me what the electric field is in region 2, then I'm going to have a different setup. Then I'm going to say what I have is a image charge like this that I'm going to call Q double prime. Okay, so this is the situation. If you ask me what the electric field is in region 1, I'm going to use these two charges. And if you ask me what the electric field is in region 2, I'm going to use this charge. I can do that, right? It seems kind of crazy, but I'm allowed to do anything I want, right? As long as I satisfy, it's a more or less free country. As long as I satisfy the boundary conditions, God's laws as opposed to Congress's laws, then I'm okay, right? They can't arrest me. So what are the boundary conditions? What has to be the case right here at the origin? Well, we know that the tangential component of the electric field has to be the same, but that's the same thing as the voltage has to be the same, right? So on the boundary, phi 1 has to be the same thing as phi 2. And the other thing that has to be the case is that the normal component of D has to be exactly the same on both sides of the boundary, because there's no free charge there, right? There's going to be bound charge there, but the D field only pays attention to free charge. Okay. So, what is the formula for the voltage here in region 1? Well, it's going to be 1 over 4 pi, and usually we would write epsilon naught, but we're in dielectric, so this is going to be epsilon, the corresponding epsilon. And then I'm going to have the real charge divided by my distance from that charge. What shall I call it? I guess I'll call it R plus. Seems like a good name. And then I'm also going to have the voltage from Q prime. So if I want to know what the voltage is at this location here, I've got R plus and I've got R minus, and that would be the formula for the voltage. If I want the voltage in region 2, what I'm going to do is just calculate things using this Q prime, right? So I'm going to write this as 1 over 4 pi epsilon 2 because I'm in dielectric, and then I'm going to have Q double prime divided by, how about 0? In the end, we're going to be interested in the value of these things on the boundary, so we're not going to be really highly concerned about it. But so this is going to be R0. Okay, so the first rule is that these formulas have to agree when I'm on the boundary. And I guess I never said it, but I'm going to put these image charges at the distance d from the boundary also. So if we think about a random spot on the boundary, then what's going to be the case is that r plus equals r minus equals r0. All of those would be the same distance.
Just a
minute. So R plus equals R minus equals R0. There's going to be an electric field in region 2, so there better be some charge that's causing it.
Okay.
Why it's this simple, I mean, why isn't it something that's a lot more complicated? Well, if it was something a lot more complicated, it wouldn't be in the book, right? So it's the simple cases that are going to be in the book. Okay, so if we write down the equation that corresponds then to the voltages being the same, what's going to happen is all of these R's are going to be the same, right? So this particular distance, it's not going to be equal to D in general, but it's going to be some particular value. And what we're going to get then is just Q plus Q prime divided by epsilon 1 better equal Q double prime divided by epsilon 2. Okay, so that was the easy equation. What do we need to have no change in the normal component of D? So what we need then, and let me call this the x direction just to give it a name. So what we need then is the electric field times the dielectric constant. So I'm going to have epsilon 1 minus the derivative with respect to x of phi in region 1. That better equal epsilon 2 times the derivative with respect to x of the voltage in region 2. So all that's saying is that there's no change in the normal component of D, which is what has to be the case if there's no free charge. So I don't know, these derivatives look like kind of a mess, but if we think about it, it's not maybe as hard as you would think. Because we know that for a point charge, if we have a voltage that was, say, 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught q divided by r minus r prime, the corresponding electric field that we get is 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught q and then r minus r prime divided by r minus r prime cubed. And this one?
Q over,
no, left.
Yeah.
That. So all of these are
epsilon.
These are epsilon naughts, not because we have an epsilon naught in our problem, but just because that's what we familiar have. But all of these other things are r minus r primes.
Oh, okay.
And that's a Q.
Yes.
So the upshot is we only want the electric field in the x direction. So we only want the component of this vector that's in the x direction. And the component of that vector that's in the x direction is d. Okay? So in general, this r minus r prime would be a vector kind of like that. But we only want the x component, and that's a constant. It's always d, no matter where that put myself on that boundary. So what I've got then, if we think about it, is we've got the electric field due to this guy. So that's going to give us 1 over 4 pi epsilon 1, because that's what we've got. And then we're going to have its charge, which is Q, its x component, which is D, and then divided by this distance cubed. Now the electric field from Q prime, it's pointing in the other direction. It has an x component that is minus d. So for that one, we're going to get minus Q prime d divided by r cubed. And that electric field needed to be multiplied by epsilon 1 in order to get the d field value. Okay, so this is the x component of the electric field due to Q. It's pointing in the positive x direction. This is the electric field due to Q prime. It's pointing in the minus x direction. In order to get D fields from E fields, we need to multiply by the corresponding epsilon. And these R's are going to be different depending upon where we are in the boundary, but in the end, they're going to be the same for all of these, so they're going to cancel out. Yeah, so all of this was E in region 1 at the boundary. So what we're going to have then is epsilon 2 times the electric field in the x component of the electric field in region 2. Yeah, they have to be equal because there has to be no change in the normal component of D. Right? So what is the electric field we would calculate in region 2? Well, we'd be using this Q double prime. So we're going to have 1 over 4 pi epsilon 2, because that's what we had in there. And then we're going to be using Q double prime, whose x vector is D. And we'd be dividing everything by R cubed. Okay, so if we rewrite everything, the epsilons cancel out, the 4 pi's cancel out, the R cubes cancel out, the D's cancel out. So this is just the statement that Q minus Q prime has to equal Q double prime. And earlier we had the equation that Q plus Q prime divided by epsilon 1 had to equal Q double prime divided by epsilon 2. So the real charge is the known. The prime charges are the things that we don't know. Two equations, two unknowns, right? We can solve for them. So, I don't know. What I see to do is to multiply this guy by epsilon 1 and then add. So if I do that, I'm going to have Q minus Q prime is equal to Q double prime. And here I'm going to get Q plus Q prime is equal to epsilon 1 over epsilon 2 times Q double prime. Q primes cancel, so I get 2Q is equal to 1 plus epsilon 1 over epsilon 2 times Q double prime. So Q double prime is going to be, well, 2 epsilon 2 divided by epsilon 1 plus epsilon 2 times Q. And I've written that in terms of epsilons, but remember these epsilons are all epsilon naughts times the corresponding dielectric constant. So this is the same thing as 2 times K2 divided by K1 plus K2. Okay, so what is Q prime? Well, if I rearrange, say, this equation here, I have that Q prime is equal to Q minus Q double prime. So what I'm going to have then is 1 minus 2K2 divided by K1 plus K2 all times Q. And if I rearrange this a little bit, I'm going to get K1 minus K2 divided by K1 plus K2 all times Q. Okay, so it's nice to make some checks. So if K1 equals K2, there really isn't a boundary. It's all one stuff. And if it's all one stuff, then what should happen is this guy should disappear, and Q double prime should be equal to Q. That is to say that when we're in region 2, which is the same thing as being any place, what we would see is the original charge. And when we're in region 1, we would see the original charge. So K1 equals K2, those things cancel, Q double prime is 0, and what we get is Q for Q double prime. If we send K2 to infinity, that should be like sitting outside of a conductor. And we've worked that problem. What we expect then is that the image charge here, Q prime, is going to be minus Q. And You can see if k2 goes to infinity, we're going to get minus infinity over infinity, which is minus 1. So we're getting that result. What's maybe a little bit confusing is what's happening to q double prime. Yeah, I am confused about what's happening to q double prime. Do I have the right formulae? Yeah, so everything's right. Apparently q double prime goes to twice q. So that sounds a little bit bad, but remember that if k2 goes to infinity, the whole electric field is going to go to zero here because of this factor here. Right, we've got a epsilon in the denominator, which is going to kill all of the electric field in region 2. And we know the electric field better be zero inside that conductor. So it is working out, even though it's working out a little bit strangely. Okay, so it's a little bit weird, but remember the overall statement is that if I can find out charges that satisfy the boundary conditions, then that has to be the solution because we have uniqueness for our solutions to Laplace's equation. So this is what, if we ask me what the electric field is in region 1, I'm going to use q and q prime. If you ask me what the electric field is in region 2, I'm going to use q double prime. Okay. Now there's a maybe some other cases that are slightly interesting. We know that if the original charge is sitting outside of a conductor, it's attracted to that conductor because of the image charge. How about if region 2 is just a dielectric? So region 2 is water and region 1 is air. Is the charge going to be attracted to the water? Well, it totally depends on the sign of q prime, right? If q prime is negative, then there's going to be attraction. And what we have is that if k2 is more than k1, the sign is going to be negative, and we're going to have attraction. How about the reverse case? How about if the original charge is sitting in water and region 2 is air? Is this charge going to be attracted to this boundary, or is it going to be repelled by this boundary? So what we have then is k1 being more than k2, in which case these two guys have the same sign, and they're going to be repelled. We'll learn that another way of thinking about this has to do with energy. That is to say, the lowest available energy is to be surrounded by high dielectric. And so this guy doesn't want to have some of his electric field in low K material. So it would much rather move into the center of the dielectric so that it has the lowest energy state. So in any case, if this guy is in water, it's going to be repelled by this boundary. If this guy is sitting outside of water, he's going to be attracted to that boundary. Oh, the Q prime equation? Okay, so that's kind of the one and only image charge problem. I think you can make image charges with spheres work, but it becomes increasingly messy, so it's not in our book. So the other problem that our book talks about, make sure I have this right, for kind of using Laplace is the case of where we have a bubble inside of a dielectric material. Well, maybe not quite said that way. What's the force on a charged particle? Inside a dielectric. So the setup is that we have a conductor which has some net charge on it, Q, and there's a previously existing electric field. What's the force on this conductor? And of course, we know what's going to happen. The electric field is going to cause polarization. So we're going to have the conductor be polarized. So we're going to get a pretty complicated formula for the surface charge density. And once we know where the charges are, we can calculate the forces. But of course, the electric field is itself going to be modified by this. It's no longer going to be a constant. So are we going to get out a fairly complicated formula in the end for what the for what seems to be a simple situation, right? You've got a little dust, a little piece of charged copper that's in water. You would think that the force on it is just going to be QE. So the tricky part of this problem is the formula that's going to come at the end. And that is that the force on this guy is the integral of the electric field times the surface charge density times dA, right? That seems like Q times E. Looks like the right stuff. But then we're going to put this one half in. So why is the force on a conductor half of what we might think? So one justification for this is that what we're really using is that 1/2 E is the average of E. Right, so the picture we have is here's the conductor, we have charge that's right on the surface, here we have an E field value, and here we have zero. And the charge that we're talking about is halfway between. So what value of E should we use? Well, it kind of makes sense that we're going to use the average value. You know, I don't know if you like that argument or not. Here's another argument. You can't push on yourself. Okay? Doesn't work. So if we're going to calculate the force on this charge, we better not include the electric field due to that charge, because it can't actually push. So here we have our surface charge density. What sort of electric field is this guy making? Well, it's making the electric field that's necessary to make sure that there is no electric field inside the conductor. So if the external charges, we're going to make an electric field that looks, say, like that. That's a bad choice, but I made it, so I have to live with it. It has to make an electric field that exactly cancels that, and therefore has to be negative. That's why I say I made a bad choice. So as a result, the electric field just outside the surface, half of it is due to that charge, and the other half of it is due to the charges that can actually push. So I don't know which one of these arguments you like better. You can argue that the surface charge density is halfway between E and zero, and so we're going to use half of the electric field. Or you could recognize that really what's happening is that you can't push on yourself, and the electric field that's just outside the surface, half of it is due to the surface charge. And it therefore can't produce a net force on the object. We can only have a net force due to the outside charge. Okay. So the rest of this problem is pretty much just the usual sort of Legendre polynomial stuff. As I say, this is the formula that's going to pop up at the end to kind of bite you. That the force that we're going to calculate is the obvious thing, electric field times charge, but then they're going to introduce this 1/2 on us. And I think instead of pursuing that Legendre polynomial, I want to take up another topic that was in the book and should. It's one of those things that if you ignore it, you're fine. But the more you think about it, the more worried you should get. We've been talking about the electric field inside something like water. But that's terribly complicated, right? So there's a oxygen nucleus, there are surrounding electrons, there are proton nucleus. Some of the region actually doesn't have electrons in it, it's vacuum. So the electric field varies tremendously, right? If you're a Fermi meter outside of this nucleus, the electric field's going to be huge. So what is this electric field that we've been calculating? And it turns out that, approximately speaking, it's the average electric field. So if you were to, you know, measure the electric field at randomly spot values, sometimes you'd be close to a nucleus, sometimes you'd be far from a nucleus. In fact, what this is giving us is the average electric field. How could you measure the electric field inside water or inside a dielectric? Right? Because depending upon where you put your probe, if you put it next to this nucleus, you're going to get a radically different result than if you put it here. And the answer is, if you wanted to find out what the electric field is inside a dielectric, one way of doing it would be to carve out a little needle and have no material there. So if the electric field is going this way, I'm going to carve out a little needle that has vacuum. Right? And outside of it, we've got all the usual material. And if I align this needle with the electric field, then we know that the tangential component of the electric field, which is all of the electric field, has to be the same across that boundary. So the electric field inside that needle will be the same as the electric field outside that needle, and since we're in vacuum, we could actually measure it, as opposed to being worried about whether our probe is near a nucleus or not. Okay, so I repeat, this is something that it, in some sense, has no consequence. If you're happy thinking about these electric fields, you can just kind of close your eyes to the realization that, in fact, it's pretty complicated. There's all sorts of charge. There are all sorts of electric fields. In fact, what we're getting is the average electric field. And if we wanted to measure it, worm out a little needle, and you'll get it. And what we'll learn in the next chapter is a little bit strange, and that is that the electric field that we're calculating is not the electric field that, say, a water molecule in the water feels. That these are different quantities. And saying this a little bit differently, it turns out it was key that I made this thing being a needle. If I had carved out a sphere, then the electric field inside of that sphere would not equal the electric field in the dielectric as a whole. And you can see it has no reason to be, right? Because there isn't a tangent to it that would be forcing it to be equal to what it is on the inside. Okay, so if you want to, you can worry about the electric field in the dielectric or not. You won't get into any trouble if you don't worry about this complication. But in fact, it's pretty complicated. Questions? So it's on to the next chapter then. Next time, I'm pretty much out of time, but let me comment that what the plan is for next time is to prove this result that I told you about, that roughly speaking, what we expect for this constant K is the volume of stuff that is atom divided by the total volume. So if we're thinking about something like air, where the fraction of volume that is atom is small, the corresponding susceptibility is going to be small. If we're thinking about something like water, where things are pretty much cheek to jowl, then we're expecting that chi is going to be pretty big. So we're going to make a pretty simple model of how atoms work, which turns out, even though it's pretty simple-minded, is not inaccurate. And work our way through that stuff. So the next chapter is kind of a deviation from usual, where we're thinking about real materials as opposed to just mathematics. Questions? So you should have those little sheets of paper where you can vote.